All right, here we go. We're back with the Sports Medicine broadcast. We're live at the Sports Medicine Update brought to you by Memorial Hermann. You got Bubba Wilson. He was on earlier. He's always on the broadcast. Great source of knowledge. He's been around for a little while. Brian Collins, I think three or four times, has been on the Sports Medicine broadcast. He's been to school twice?
Yes, twice.
Been to school twice and been out here last year. And then we got Will Ryan. He was on here on earlier today, right?
Yes.
And then Amber Jones, I think this is your first time?
Second.
Second time?
Yeah.
Did you come to the school or what?
Yeah,
is it when
I came to the school.
Okay,
well then third. Forgot you came to the school.
All right. So everybody here, obviously I've been on once or twice before, or 140 times. So I'm the host, Jeremy Jackson. We got the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Check it out. We're at live at the Sports Medicine Update. Ryan and Bubba working with Dr. Crumby, doing some, trying to figure out how to change how we're doing ACL rehab instead of just a, you know, hey, he's 6 weeks out, you should be able to do this, 12 weeks out, you should be able to do this. They want to make it so that, hey, he can actually bend his leg this far, or he can do a bodyweight squat, or whatever, things like that. And so they're working towards shifting it like that. And so just reconstructing the way that ACL rehab is done. Ryan, take it away. What do you got for us?
Well, I can't start talking without giving Bubba Wilson here credit for the implementation, the direction of this project. Both of us have kind of been working apart from each other, and then kind of when we started talking about it, kind of melded well together. But basically what we're focusing on was getting a standardized protocol that doesn't involve just waiting for patients and a number to correspond with each other. So getting outcomes, getting performance-based measures to be the criteria to move on, to get them back to sports, to get them back to running. And it helped with the other people of Memorial Hermann, the Lane Bailey, the Director of Research and Education, as well as Dr. Lowe and all his staff, getting them involved has really kind of expedited the process, where we thought it was just going to be an easy Word and PowerPoint presentation turns into publishing and research and, you know, lots of other people.
It's a 35-page book as of right now.
Yeah, it'll probably end up being 45 once you're done with all the other exercise lists and references and things like that. But it's been exciting. It's been fun. And it's good because it helps me implement new things into my practice and see how it works out. And you get firsthand knowledge and feedback whenever you use it yourself. So like we talked about today with some of the breakouts, it may be that, you know, with this project being kind of the infantile stage, it may be that some of these criteria that we're setting are just impossible to pass. And so we're not at all thinking that this is in concrete, set in stone, ready to go. We want to see how it kind of goes live, see how people respond to it, more or less make sure that therapists outside of the ones who have been working so closely with it can replicate it on their own too.
Ryan, just based off what we've talked about in your talk here, I want you to kind of touch on two things, then I'll let them ask some questions. The first one is squat progression, starting with body squats. Talk a little bit about that and some of the need, and then talk about the, I'm going to put it this way, the lack of posterior chain, that gets done, and some of the importance of that.
Yeah, I think with the squat mechanics, when you see somebody come in before they're injured, you know, if they just, let's say they have just a mild strain, typically even with a healthy individual with two healthy knees, their squat mechanics are poor. They haven't had the necessary time and practice to develop those mechanics, but they haven't had the direction put on them in the schools because of the coach to student ratio. So those mechanics are usually pretty sorry coming into it. But after ACLs, you kind of have a chance to hit the reset button. So whenever they start going from things like sit to stands, you can focus on knee and hip and foot mechanics, getting everything in proper alignment, working on trunk positioning, and then as you progress into a resisted exercise, really emphasizing the things that typically do fail. You know, spinal positioning with a back squat, you always see the bad the picture of the guy who's basically got his back in line with his hips. He's just, you know, looks like a bent over version of himself. So focusing on upright postures, you can do those with exercises like goblet squats, emphasizing the core to keep them in a good position. And then hopefully that carries over to when you start doing more advanced lifts like front squats and back squats if that's what they do in their strength and conditioning program with their teams. But, you know, as Bubba alluded to, the posterior chain, your glutes and your hamstrings play a key role in not only stabilizing the leg and helping the performance of the motions, the lifts, but also add to and can improve your performance if you have those muscles producing the same amount of output that the quads, you know, the quads do. The quads are the primary movement for any sort of vertical motion, but you can get a lot of benefit from adding in the posterior chain as well. So I think instead of just doing typical table exercises for your butt with the band around your knee, you can really start to load it up with different exercises, hip thrusts, bridges, and then focusing on the hamstring, like, you know, with RDLs, good mornings. So there's a variation, a gamut of different exercises, glute ham devices, things that probably should be implemented more, because a lot of the athletes and sports that we're dealing with involve a lot of running. And like I mentioned in the presentation, the glutes and hamstrings are key for running mechanics and running performance.
So real quick, talk about in the squat progression from body squat to goblet squat. What's your progression up? We've talked about this a bunch, but obviously these people haven't heard it. What's your progression up to back squatting?
So I would go starting off with a sit to stand and then making sure that they're putting 50% through each leg. There's no sense in doing a strength exercise if one leg's doing a greater amount of the work. You're not going to get the benefit on the involved side. So making sure they feel comfortable and can replicate a 50% squat. Once they can just get a 50% sit to stand, which is just getting up and down from a chair with good mechanics, you can go into a basic body weight squat, like Bubba's alluding to, like a back squat would give, a box squat would basically give them a point of reference to go down to, touch, and come back up. And then a goblet squat is a variation of just a full squat where they hold an implement, whether it's a dumbbell, a plate, or a bar in front of them, a landmine. And then it's more of a hip mobility, trunk stability type of squat where you really emphasize upright trunk position. And then really getting down into that motion where the glutes and the hamstrings are having to fire to keep the knee in a good position, but also the mechanics of anterior tibial translation, getting the knee to go towards the toes, not necessarily over, but towards the toes, so you load the quads primarily. So after a goblet squat, and they can replicate that, for me in particular, I would go to a front squat because it's the closest thing to a goblet squat where the resistance is in front of the body, so there's still that good upright positioning. Because I think what we see and, you know, what you hear about with a lot of injuries coming from that heavy back squat is the lumbar spine is having to do so much work that you end up with these lumbar strains to eventually spondylosis all the way up to listhesis because of all that stress they're putting on their lumbar spine because they don't have the trunk control. They don't have the leg strength to hold up that heavy weight on their back. So, yeah, so goblets basically sit to stand up to goblet squat, eventually to a front squat, and then back squat once they demonstrate they can do all the rest previously. But most of the time you can get a required load by doing either unilateral exercises with a heavier load that you can. So if you do a back squat, let's say with 200 pounds on your back, would it be safer to do that with, you know, a unilateral exercise with 100 pounds, which is more likely to avoid injury, which is more likely to address the strength that you're looking for? So unless they can't, if they can't perform a back squat correctly, I would never do it for rehab purposes.
Yeah. So you talked a lot about, you know, some of the functional exercises that you do, the single leg squat, quad activation. So those are more, I guess, objectively measured tests. Are there any subjective assessments that you are utilizing for this study?
Yeah, the IKDC is a survey that they fill out at the beginning of, basically the beginning of the rehab all the way up towards the end. Also the Tampa Kinesiophobia Scale is another one towards the end when you're looking at sports movements. A lot of the time, what we don't know as therapists, if the patient's kind of withheld, is are they fearful of re-injuring themselves? Are they holding back because they don't feel like they should or can do what they were doing before? And so some of these subjective scales kind of gives us insight into, yeah, they have good strength, but maybe we need to just kind of keep practicing these predictable drills until this individual feels more comfortable doing these exercises. Because if they go out on the field and run a drill or play in a competitive environment, and they're not ready to put the stress needed into that leg. You're looking at either an injury to that side or most likely an injury to the uninvolved side because it's carrying all the stress now. So those two scales, I can't think of anything else.
The other's visual analog.
Other than the pain.
Yeah,
so those
not a big of a deal.
Those subjective scales be ones that kind of give us the insight that is this patient ready and this athlete ready to get back to competition.
And how often do you see, I mean, so let's say, you know, you're in phase two of the rehab process and the patient, you know, objectively their strength is great. They're not going into knee valgus or anything like that. However, they are not meeting, the standards on the subjective scales. Do you withhold them from progressing into phase three or?
Okay. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, we haven't come across yet because it hasn't really gone live, is some of these athletes accidentally injured themselves, mm-hmm. right? You have the ninth grade volleyball girl who's playing volleyball because her dad made her, or you have this eighth grade boy who's been told he needs to play football, injures his knee, but he doesn't at all want to go back to play sports. So they may have on their radar in the back of their mind that we're not aware of, they have no interest in going back. So they're always going to kind of say, I don't think I can play. I don't think I should do it. So those kind of accidental injuries would probably be something that would hold them back that you can't do anything about.
And the way I look at that aspect of it, I think that's the point where we talked earlier. They're not progressing. That's no longer our conversation. That's a higher up conversation. If maybe you tell the doctor, hey, this score here on IKDC or Tampa isn't real good. I don't know if they want to play. They won't really talk to us. So maybe they need to talk to the doctor or go see a therapist. That's a lot of that's what that's for.
Right.
And we just don't have yet enough data being infancy to know, ooh, yeah, this matters, or maybe we tweak those numbers. We don't know. Ryan, talk a little bit about, you touched on them there, like the suitcase lift and all this. Talk a little bit about the lateral trunk aspect of some of this stuff.
So, anti-movement core strengthening, you're looking at, can you maintain a good upright trunk position? And then eventually through strength training exercises all the way up to dynamic activity. If you think about a running back who's making a sharp cut, right? That planted foot is on the ground, but their body's trying to get away from that. So if you're looking at somebody and you take a cut to the left, your body doesn't move as one segment. Typically your upper body, your torso gets out of the way, and that left, that foot that you cut on is left behind. And what you want to see is with that lateral core strength and just core strength in general, can you maintain a good trunk position to maintain as much of a balance as possible? So you lose your balance whenever your center of mass is way outside of your base of support. Unless you can control that center of mass to maintain a close proximity to your base support, those cuts, that agility is a little bit more clean. You see less stumbling. So like with lateral core exercises, if the left oblique is the one that we're activating, we're hoping to see that the body doesn't want to tend to tilt to or over to the right side. So if this is going to activate on the left, you don't pick up a heavy weight on the right side and just see it slump over. Think about a basketball player in the low post, right? They're backing down somebody, and if you don't have that trunk stability, that core stability, that defender can knock you off of your post. They can knock you off of your base support, so you look like a 2x4 falling over to the side. That in general lateral core, but also just general core stability, and is kind of meant to resist the destabilizing torques effect on your performance.
Are y'all going to extend your research to
everybody but you?
What do you call them? Dang it! Weight training coaches, because from my experience, I've been in the weight room and they're teaching them or having them do squats, and they're doing it all wrong, like you said, like from high school, like they haven't been taught correctly
right.
How to do it. How do we in college or high school go about telling them, like, hey, maybe.
Collaborate with the strength.
Yeah.
The best answer to how do you collaborate, collaborating with a strength and conditioning specialist is one thing. Collaborating with a coach, good luck. Coaches are creatures of habit. Coaches know everything. Just ask them, they'll tell you. The problem, and Ryan and I have had this conversation a lot too, and actually Rashad did something a couple of weeks ago on this, and we had good feedback, but part of the problem is I did this 30 years ago, and this is what we're going to do. Well, again, everything changes and everything evolves. It's hard to get a coach to buy in unless they see a need, and usually when they see a need is they've lost enough players, they go, well, maybe something's wrong. A strength and conditioning coach, for the most part, is a little easier in your setting, in a college setting, because they've got them. The coaches aren't dictating what they're doing. They're setting that up. And then I think if you can, you get the buy-in of saying, hey, a good strength coach should be pre-screening them, FMS or something, to say, you don't even need to touch the bar right now. And then progressing them on. And then, you know, in my opinion, the good, you know, he's got his. And so we talk a lot about, I would say they're yours, I don't want him to do this. And then his job would be to work within those parameters. And that's a long way, again, to say, yeah, good luck. We don't know. We're trying to do some things, but it's hard to convince the coach that what they do is wrong. You can't go about it that way. You've got to give them tidbits that they can look and see, and then all of a sudden the light will go on. And when the light goes on, you've got them. But how long does it take to get the light to go on? That's difficult. Much like sports metrics. Sports metrics is great. But your basketball coach isn't wanting to give up that time during the class period unless they've had 2, 3, 4 ACLs of kids that couldn't play anymore that were starters. And then now it matters. So usually you've got to have the catastrophe in their eyes to justify it over here.
What else did you cover in your lecture in there?
We talked about core strength, which we've mentioned. We talked about the protocol, squat progressions. What else we talked about? We talked about subjective reporting, some of the outcome measures that kind of aren't on us, but more on the patient to kind of determine why the patient's not progressing. It could be more subjective. It could be something that they're feeling rather than what they're performing.
I saw in your breakout session, what were some of the feedback or questions you were getting in there?
Well, a lot of it was how to utilize or how to create a handheld dynamometer in their clinic. So for us, with this protocol, we're utilizing either the isokinetic device or a handheld dynamometer to get a qualitative number for strength that we can report and collect with data. So to see progressions in strength, but also to compare involved and uninvolved, compare quad hamstring ratios. So that was the biggest issue, is how am I supposed to do that if I don't have the device? How am I supposed to, you know, get that as part of my checkoff list if said patient comes from Flatonia and we're a doctor who did the surgery in Houston, right, and has these protocols set, but the people in Flatonia have, you know, nothing that they can replicate with our stuff. So I think that was our biggest issue, is trying to figure out a way to get everybody on the same page and have the same devices, not necessarily to have the same numbers exactly, but be able to replicate the same.
And so what were some of your suggestions for that? So you have an athletic trainer that just doesn't have the equipment that you have prescribed in this protocol. So what's your suggestion?
Well, we have Bubba has a couple suggestions that he is he's working on, coming an app for the phone, with the smartphone, eventually having a pressure gauge, being able to be attached to that with an application that can then help read and collect the data. That's probably way down the line, but also the digital fishing scale, where basically, you know, weight of a fishing weight scale. So basically, you attach some type of strap to the scale, you know, hold the scale, and have the individual pull on that scale. So any sort of way you can get something to replicate a number.
Some sort of objective. I mean, even if what's the scale that you would use to measure the pounds of apples at a grocery store?
Exactly.
Something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, somebody mentioned a blood pressure cuff, which I guess is a way to see a number. Mm-hmm. You know, pushing on the cuff to get a number to occur. I don't know how well that's going to carry over because of the bladder and how much force it can withstand, but yeah, I mean, those types of things, there's bound to be ways that you can get a replicable number through that. So that's kind of, I think, our biggest issue, is just making sure that this protocol is something that we can create in every environment.
And so if I were to transition over to, right, Will and Amber, here you have two, you know, second year MAT students, and, you know, this time next year they will be in the workforce.
Right.
And so what are some of the things that you want them to know about knee injuries, about this particular protocol, about, you know, what do you want them to do or how to use, you know, your findings?
Well, I think the first thing, and with any sort of program, whether it be strength and conditioning, athletic training, or physical therapy, is you want to improve performance and reduce injury. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't prevent injury, especially with sport. There's going to be a 100% chance something happens, whether it's small, minute, or all the way up to ACL and beyond. But as you know, improving performance would be, you know, making sure, like we talked about, technique is optimal. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you're in the gym, or you have access to some of those kids that come to you, say, hey, this has been feeling weird when I do a specific movement, is to really coach them on proper technique and have them be able to replicate that. So if it is something like a back squat where they're just talking about back pain, every time I sit in class, I get up, I'm stiff, it hurts. Go through regressions in exercise variance, but also resistance to make sure that they can, if they can perform it correctly, that they're not doing something to damage themselves down the road. But also with injury prevention is making sure that, you know, the mechanics, whether it's lifts, whether it's jumps, you know, that they understand what they need to do for strengthening. Let's say that, you know, all their single leg exercises, they have a lot of that knee valgus, foot pronation, trunk control issues. I enjoyed the certified strength and conditioning certification that I have, because it opened my eyes more so to that strength and conditioning world that is kind of lost in the rehab setting.
Dynamic, you know, it's dynamic kinetic chain. That's really what it is.
Right. So, you know, knowing, having a larger vocabulary of exercises than TKEs, box squats, wall squats, and, you know, hip active range of motion, straight leg raises, knowing that there's other things you can do to address those muscles and knowing the muscles. So not losing, once you finish school, not losing the joy or the knowledge base of being, you know, being a master of the muscle, being a master of the body. So if they come in and they can't quite finish out a squat, so they end up with a lot of lumbar flexion, knowing that, you know, hey, maybe if we kick in their glutes a little bit more and emphasize with our technique, locking out their glutes and knees at the same time, getting that co-contraction may avoid excessive lumbar strain. So I'd say, I mean, it all comes down to, I think, making sure the technique is sound, mm-hmm. making sure the mechanics are good, but then also knowing how to improve that, improve on those mechanics, how to improve on those exercises.
And so what do you think about systems like the functional movement screen, some of those other protocols that we have in place to identify some weaknesses? And how do those relate to some of the things that you're doing?
Well, we've put the FMS overhead squat into one of our criteria phases, mm-hmm. where it demonstrates symmetry and weight bearing. It demonstrates good alignment, knees, hips, but also shows good trunk control. Right? If you have poor trunk control, as soon as you start loading, like we talked about with back squats, as soon as you start loading your axial spine and you don't have that control, somewhere along the way, along the chain, something's going to have to compensate for that. And mm-hmm. that's where you tend to have those injuries, nagging injuries or devastating injuries. I think the FMS definitely has a place in assessment. I don't think it's the gold standard.
Sure.
Everything, because everybody's going to be a little different. And not everybody is going to be symmetrical. I think that's something that we have to keep in mind. Maybe a bilateral squat could be, but if you have a dotted leg, maybe your single leg squat on the left versus the right is not going to look exactly the same. So I think they have their place. I think they'll probably will show the wow factor, sort of the that's an obvious issue that we need to address. Mm-hmm. The small kind of small things here and there, probably not such a big deal, but it definitely will present if somebody doesn't have the necessary ankle mobility to perform a good squat, so they're left with knee, hip, and back compensations. Well, maybe that FMS can kind of clear that up, mm-hmm. give us an indication where to address the technique, address with exercise and intervention, and then it clears up.
So what other types of, you know, you address the certified strength conditioning specialist, mm-hmm. and so now, you know, NASM has, you know, a certified exercise specialist or a corrective exercise specialist,
yeah.
PES performance. you know, for somebody, again, like Will and Amber coming out of school, you know, how well are those post-certification credentials going to help them? And to understand how that body moves and marketability for employment, et cetera.
I think taking a test doesn't make you an expert. I think staying informed, continually keeping up with the latest research, and just in general being interested in your profession is going to allow you to see what realm of athletic training you fall into. There's different areas that you can kind of go into. So for me, you know, with physical therapy, I enjoyed the sports side of it, whereas there's an orthopedic and a neuro side. So these certifications, one, kind of help you with employment, just in general, seeing that this is what I like to do. And you can see on my resume and my credentials, this is what I like to do. So I'm showing, you know, with these credentials, with these certifications, that this is what I'm good at, this is what I have interest in. So I tend to do more, do better in the places that I have an interest in. For me, I just enjoy learning something new. So that's kind of why I've done these certifications, is that it keeps me interested in my job. If I can come up with a new way to address quad strength, rather than doing, you know, the stuff that I learned in school, it makes me want to do that new thing and then find something that may be potentially better. And then being around people who are smarter than you, that always helps, because then you learn, continually learn. That's, I think, the key.
I think to piggyback off that, networking is always important. And that's one of the things I love with what I do, is I get to talk to him anytime I want, or any of the other therapists. I can just go and say, hey, blah, 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 question on this, or just catch up or whatever. That's always good. But talking about the CES or the PES, in their environment, and the way we're set up at Memorial Hermann, some of those qualifications matter. Mm-hmm. For advancement and different things. I'll be honest, in the high school setting, if you got your CES or PES, that coach AD doesn't necessarily care. They might ask you what those letters are. They don't necessarily care. But what it does is again, it makes you, I'm gonna say, a little more knowledgeable and a little more current than your competitor. Mm-hmm. The other person may be applying for that job or going in. And I think in some ways it makes you a better athletic trainer. You don't have to have that, but it to me, it shows, hey, you know, I've thought about taking those tests myself, even right now, even though I don't need them. But I think if you're a little more, you're current, you know what's going on, you've got a better understanding of some of this. We've got this issue, this is what we need to do to fix it. You know, it's strengthen here, inhibit over here, whatever it is, a little bit of both, you have a better understanding of that. But from a hiring standpoint, it's not necessarily gonna put you over the top. It's, you know, it's more
marketability to get you in the door, and then interview skills and
right
what you're able to bring to the table to that particular company.
You know, an AD head football coach in a high school doesn't care how many letters you have behind your name. Do you have the right ones? Do we think you can do the job, and do we like it? It still boils down to that. When you get going in that job, that you can utilize those skills. They stay. And now the way I look at it is, they want to come in and see you working those kids hard and going, well, that's interesting. They really are trying to get them back. You know, it's a perception versus reality thing in there, too. And so when they see that, they go, that's different. That, what are you doing with them? Well, we're working. Oh, that's a pretty good idea. Then they'll pick your brain for something else. Some other stuff we're talking about. Now, all of a sudden, hey, can you help us do this? You're not having to go in and try to, you know, take a big chunk out. They'll come to you.
Interesting. All right. I have to excuse myself. Will, Amber, any more questions? I mean, you guys really asked a lot.
Well,
just learning. So, I mean, what do you think about this experience so far? Overwhelming, right?
Oh yeah, the a lot of information. Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, good. And I mean, you feel like you're prepared to digest all the information, and that's good.
Getting there.
That's good.
They have to say yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have to.
Yeah.
Say yes.
You're sitting in front of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Excuse me. Yeah. I'll see you guys in a little bit.
Thoughts on the ACL update?
No, I think as we get further and further into it and refine more and more, we'll kind of see where it takes us. But it's been fun. It's been.
Did you give an approximate date for when that's coming out? Did you say that earlier?
Football season.
I can tell. Yeah, I want it going within our positions and our clinics by those main clinics by football season. I think that can happen. I've got to get Dr. Lowe to say yes and then get him to do his other part of that, and it'll all fall into place from there. And then we're going to publish the protocol. Will be the next step after that. And then while we're not I'm not smart enough to write it, while Lane is writing it, and just put my name on it, and Ryan's, we'll be collecting the data and working on that second aspect of that as well. And then hopefully a year from now, a year into it, so next fall we'll have a year's worth of data that we can then look at and try to publish the data and see if it's doing what we think it's doing or should do. And again, like Ryan said, we may look at something and go, nobody passes that or everybody passes that. Mm-hmm. We need to tweak this. We know it's a fluid document. Mm-hmm. You know, and even if you say we like this, it should always be fluid. We should always be looking at it and going, can we make it better? You know, and maybe something, new test comes out that's been validated that you go, ooh, I really like that. Let's drop that in and use it. And that's how it ought to be.
I think once more and more and more people start implementing it and using it is where the problems will start to arise. Is, you know, how can you do this? And then you have everybody's an individual, so you're going to have individual players who come in. Think about like a professional athlete whose strength scores are probably phase four, but yet they just had surgery 3 weeks ago. So you're going to have those outliers that are going to kind of put this protocol to the test and kind of figure out, all right, well, what's the rule for physical specimens? You know, what's the rule for people who are accelerated beyond accelerated, and we just have to slow them down because they can already pass all these tests, but yet histologically they're not anywhere near the strain that's going to take to do things like, you know, jumping and running. So time will tell, I think.
So, and are you going to have separate categories for, you know, isolated ACL patients and then, you know, people with, you know, the terrible triad with
no.
ACL? And okay,
so no, because if you look at it, the only thing that changes, okay, the only thing that changes is initially is your protection phase of your range of motion and your weight bearing status. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that differentiates those between. Obviously, if you're ACL, PCL, this thing's out the window. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's a total different animal if they do them at the same time. But let's say you're ACL, you're a triad. We're going to protect the MCL and the meniscus depending on what we do with the meniscus. So that's all in our phase one. Once you're allowed to weight bear and have full motion or have your motion start progressing, you can come out of phase one when you meet those criteria.
Okay.
And obviously things like microfractures and bone healing and issues like that. Let's say you have an older patient who tore their ACL and they have a lot of cartilage damage and they had that microfracture and the doctor says, hey, this is not the guy you're going to heavy lift. This is not the guy that's going to go back to running marathons. That's when it's individualized, where you can skip on the plyometrics. Right, you want this guy to be able to go to work and take care of his family and exercise in the gym when he wants to. So I think that's when it comes to be an individualized protocol, which is good because it puts the emphasis on the patient to kind of determine where they want to go. But the criteria in themselves, the criteria doesn't change. You just know where you're going to stop, where that glass ceiling is for those okay. people.
Yeah, like ACL microfracture, we know they're non-weight bearing for 6 weeks. We might give them all their motion, but yet we still can't advance because we can't fully bear weight.
Yeah.
Once we can fully bear weight, here we go. And again, I'm done snow skiing. I just want to be able to jog. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we know where we got to get you to. That's our end stage for this guy. Maybe we step a little bit more outside of just jogging for some strength stuff, but we're not too worried about plyometrics and agilities because they're like, I'm done, you know.
Okay.
The good thing about the protocol is that you can show a person, this is what we need to be able to do to get you to this point versus where there's a post-op week, and at 32 weeks, now you can start doing these activities. Well, they don't know what it's going to take to do those activities. So with this protocol, we have listed out strength measurements. We have listed out the test, and any time you want, you can say, this is the test that you're going to need to be able to pass. And what that may do is provide incentive for that patient to really focus on single leg balance. Provide them the incentive to go to the gym more than just twice a week therapy so they can get their strength back so they can jog and they can run. So it's good to, you know, put that emphasis on the patient, like I mentioned before, because it is laid out. It's not at 30, we can't talk about what's going to happen in 6 months because you're not there yet. You know, if you want to be able to do this, this is what we need to be able to do. So in the meantime, let's Let's work on it.
Okay.
All right, Brett's up. You got anything?
I think she announced.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Ryan, thanks for joining us. I'm excited.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Since you guys work right here by us, I'm sure we'll see it pretty soon after get it ready to go out the door. Hopefully I can help you guys some collect some information. So
yeah.
Brian Collins, physical therapist, Memorial Hermann, again on the sports medicine broadcast at Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Update. Thanks.